Okay, is that working? Hello? Is it working? Okay. Thank you. Cool. Thank you for having me here tonight. I was just telling David, I realized I've been all over the state of Virginia before, but I don't think I've ever been to Lynchburg. So, exciting to finally be here. I know a number of people from this church. Of course, Riley and Tamara, also Virgil's daughter, Becca, was a friend of mine out in Moscow as well. So great to meet all of you and to talk about the Reformation here as we approach the 499th anniversary of Luther nailing the 95 Theses on October 31st. Now, the three stories that, if I have time for all three, which I may not because I have a tendency to ramble, so we'll see. But I've chosen three stories which are not related to that directly, to the nailing the 95 Theses, but perhaps somewhat less known stories from the Reformation that all have some connection to this time of year, as I'll highlight. And also, I think one thing that they all have in common is they all pose the question of what does faithful Christian witness in the midst of persecution and opposition look like? When is discretion the better part of valor? When should Christians, what are appropriate forms of compromise that are necessary for the advancement of God's kingdom? When should we stand on principle and refuse to compromise? If we stand on principle and refuse to compromise, should we stay and accept the consequences, or should we move to somewhere safer? And I think these are questions that Christians are really facing today in the midst of an increasingly hostile society. To what extent should we work within the structures of a hostile society? And if we are working within in those structures, how do we know how to pick our battles and how to be able to kind of lay low when necessary in order to be able to have some influence in that setting? Or when do we pull out of those structures in order to maintain faithfulness? Or when do we stay in those structures and be bold witnesses and accept the persecution that comes? So the different stories that we're going to look at are all in different ways showing kind of different dynamics of compromise and faithfulness in the Reformation. So first, show of hands. We're going to go through here. We'll probably get a unanimous show of hands to begin with, and then it'll get smaller. So who all here has heard of Martin Luther? All right. John Calvin. All right. Ulrich Zwingli. All right. Still doing pretty good. Good. Thomas Cranmer. All right. Ooh, this is good. This is good. Heinrich Bullinger. Ooh, get that. Heinrich Bullinger. Wait, let's hold that about six. Martin Bucer. Martin Bucer. Anyone who's been to Moscow, Idaho, knows Bucer's Coffee House. Peter Martyr Vermigli. Ooh, all right. We got three. All right. So that's the one that I want to start with here, is Peter Martyr Vermigli. And Vermigli is fascinating in so many ways. You could really tell the whole story of the Reformation through his life, because he ends up participating, either being geographically present in almost every place where the Reformation happens, or at least being closely connected personally to people who are involved in the leadership of different regions of the Reformation. So we often think of the Reformation as kind of, well, we know what happened in Germany, we know what happened in England and in the Netherlands, and we know, and in Switzerland, of course. In France, the Reformation had a kind of a rocky time, but we are aware of that there was definitely a Reformation in France. But we tend to think of the Reformation as not happening at all south of the Alps. But in fact, there was a vibrant Italian Reformation that unfortunately was thoroughly quashed by the Inquisition, but still yielded a lot of fruit in the fact that there were Italian Protestant scholars who came north fleeing the persecution of the Inquisition and had tremendous influence in centers of the Reformation in Northern Europe. And Peter Martyr Vermigli is the greatest of these. In fact, he was acknowledged by his contemporaries to be perhaps the greatest intellect among all of the Protestant reformers. So he was born in 1499 in the city of Florence, Italy. So this is the period when Michelangelo is in Florence. Florence is really kind of the center of the Renaissance at this time. And he goes to study. He becomes a monk at the age of 15 and went to study in 1518 at the University of Padua, which was considered perhaps the greatest university in Europe at that time. So this is right after Martin Luther has started the Reformation in northern Germany. But he's an Augustinian monk in Italy, which is the heart of the Catholic Church. And the Augustinian order is, that's actually Luther's order as well. It's the most prominent order of monks in the Catholic Church. And in Italy, they have tremendous influence. So in Padua, he studied he studied the scriptures. He learned Hebrew and Greek. He was considered one of the greatest Hebrew scholars in the among the Protestant reformers. So he learned Hebrew. He taught himself Greek, actually, and read the church fathers, read the medieval scholastics, also studied classical literature a great deal. And you'll find in his works he likes to cite not merely theologians, but he'll cite Aristotle, cite Cicero, he'll cite Galen and Hippocrates, who were famous ancient Greek teachers of medicine. So he liked to study biology and medicine as well. So he really had a comprehensive liberal arts education, which he brought to bear in all of his scholarship later in life. So in the 1520s, he becomes friends with a fellow named Reginald Pole, who is an Englishman who's come to Italy, who's actually the cousin of Henry VIII, the King of England, who we'll come back to in another story. And so Pole and Vermigli both begin, they're not Protestant at this time, but they both feel strongly that the Church of Rome has many corruptions that need to be dealt with. The monastic life has become very corrupt. The papal authority is no longer serving the church, but oppressing the church. Priests are not doing their job of teaching the people the scriptures. Very few priests really know the scriptures at all. So they become part of a reforming movement in Italy that is focused on studying the scriptures daily, that is focused on trying to live them out faithfully instead of a kind of minimalism that you really had, right? Where you could just do kind of the bare minimum, and then you could go and you could get the sacraments and you could do confession to the priest and make sure you got your bases covered. You know, you could buy some indulgences to lessen your time in purgatory and so on. So it didn't really foster a really serious spiritual life. So Pole and Vermigli, they made friends also with a guy named Gasparo Contarini, another Italian Augustinian. And together, they kind of start this reform program throughout the Augustinian order. They're determined to kind of bring the Augustinian order much more into line with its original founding principles and in line with what Scripture teaches and what they read in the Church Fathers. They're also beginning to read, especially Vermigli, Protestant works by Luther and by Zwingli that have been smuggled over from Germany. So Vermigli's not a convinced Protestant at this time, but he thinks that a lot of the things Luther is saying are true, and he's trying to kind of slowly but surely work some of these reforms in into the Italian church. Now, he actually becomes the general of the Augustinian order. So he is the top guy in the entire Augustinian order of monks in Italy. So he's one of the most important churchmen in all of Italy, and he's sort of becoming secretly a Protestant, right? But at this time, the papacy kind of went back and forth, and during this period, the Pope, whose name was, I should remember this, Paul IV. Yeah, no, wait, that's a later Pope. Well, if I don't remember it, you don't really need to remember it. So, anyway, the guy who is the Pope at this time is much more reform-minded and actually appoints a commission to look into the abuses in the church and say, okay, look, you know, Luther's gone too far, but we obviously have some serious problems and we need to clean house. And so he appoints this commission to investigate the abuses in the church and recommend what the church needs to do to get its act in order. So Vermigli is appointed this commission, Reginald Pole is appointed, Gasparo Contarini, and then two others who become kind of leading figures in the Counter-Reformation. Jacopo Sadoleto, who's famous because Calvin wrote a famous text called Reply to Sadoleto, and a guy named Giovanni Carafa, who becomes the leader of the Inquisition, but at this time is committed to reform. So in the late 1530s, they are working for reform. They commit. They submit a kind of program for reform right at the heart of the papal church. And this seems to be yielding a lot of fruit. In fact, in 1541, Vermigli's friend Contarini is... Contarini. Yes, of course. So in 1540, actually, Contarini is sent as part of a delegation to Germany to meet with the Protestant theologians. I'm sorry, my phone is dinging. This is very embarrassing. Turn this off. Hang on a second. There we go. So this is known as the Colloquy of Regensburg. And this was an actual attempt by the Protestant. This is 24 years after Luther's nailed the 95 Theses. And it seems like the split between the Protestants and Rome is irreversible. But there's an attempt to come up with a formula that they can agree on. So Contarini is sent and is corresponding with Vermigli about I think these Protestants have a lot of good points. What kind of statement can we come up with that the Pope will sign on to and that the Protestants will sign on to, and maybe we can actually heal this breach and bring Reformation to the heart of the church? Because, of course, remember, the purpose of the Reformation to begin with was not to split away and start a new church, but was to reform the entire church. And so Luther and the Protestants in Germany wanted to find a way to convince the papal leadership to reform the church from within. And this was, the Colloquy of Regensburg was the best attempt that they had for this. So they actually came up with a statement of doctrine at the colloquy that Luther wasn't there, but his assistant Melanchthon was. And Contarini and Melanchthon agreed to a set of articles of faith that seemed like both sides could mostly agree on. They kind of found some common ground on justification and on the doctrine of the church and a lot of the other things that were dividing them. And Vermigli at this time is kind of running a school of Augustinian priests at... where is he at this point? Is he still at Naples? No, I don't think he's at Naples. But again, if I don't remember, you probably don't really care. So somewhere in northern Italy that I really should remember. Because anyway, and things are looking really good. Vermigli is basically pretty much a complete closet Protestant at this time. He's pretty much signed onto the whole Protestant faith, but he's being careful about it, right? He's actually teaching Protestant ideas to several other leading members of the Augustinian order in Italy, but he's keeping a low profile. Because there's still certainly some strong anti-Protestant elements in the Italian church. But it looks like, if Contarini is successful, that the Pope himself might accept a lot of the Protestant reforms. Unfortunately, there's a huge change that happens during the colloquy, and Cardinal Carafa, who had collaborated with Vermigli and Contarini, becomes convinced that, yes, reform is needed, but not in any way on the terms the Protestants want to do it. The reform, in fact, needs to reassert papal authority and kind of use papal authority to kind of clean house. And so the Italian Inquisition starts up, and they start rounding people up. And Contarini is summoned back from Regensburg. The document that he came up with is kind of shredded. They say, we're not going to go for this at all. And Vermigli comes under a lot of pressure. So at this point, Vermigli says, you know what, okay, it's been good, but it's time to, I can't kind of keep a low profile anymore. So he packs his bags, he heads north to Switzerland, and he shows up in Zurich, the heart of the Swiss Reformation, says, hey, you know, I'm a leading Catholic clergyman from Italy, and I'm actually on your side now. So it was sort of this, you know, weird moment for them, you know. It must have been like actually sort of when the Apostle Paul kind of first comes in and says, hey, you know, I was persecuting you, and I'm actually a Christian now. You know, so they're kind of freaked out at first. They're like, you know, is he a spy, or what's going on here? So they kind of drill him for like 5 days, you know, in his theology. Like, wow, this guy's actually a full-fledged Protestant. So Bullinger says, well, you know, we need to put you to use here. And they need someone to teach theology in Strasbourg, which is where Bucer is. So he goes to Strasbourg, starts teaching theology there for a few years. And then an even bigger opportunity comes where in 1548, in the English Reformation, which I'll come back to, the English Reformation is finally, King Henry VIII has died, and they finally have some freedom to really teach fully Protestant ideas in the Church of England. So Thomas Cranmer, who's the Archbishop of Canterbury, once starts inviting leading Protestants from all over Europe to come to England and teach in the universities of Oxford and Cambridge. So Martin Bucer comes over from Germany and becomes the professor of theology at Cambridge, and Vermigli comes over and becomes the professor of theology at Oxford. And over the next 5 years, Bucer and Vermigli and Cranmer collaborate to establish many of the documents that then make up the Protestant Church of England. The Book of Common Prayer is composed by Cranmer with a lot of input from Bucer and Vermigli. And the 39 Articles of Religion are also put in place. Then Vermigli is also responsible for a big reform of the ecclesiastical laws in England to try to get rid of some of the old Catholic structures of authority. Unfortunately, that last project is left unfinished when Edward VI, who's the really Protestant-minded young king of England, dies suddenly in 1553. I think he's only 16 at the time. So, and unfortunately, the successor is Edward's older sister, Queen Mary, who's known as Bloody Mary, because she is a devout Catholic, and she comes back. She comes over, and in fact, her husband is the crown prince of the Holy Roman Empire, so which is the great Catholic monarchy of Austria and Spain. So you have not merely a Catholic coming to the throne of England, but her husband is about to become the emperor of the great Catholic power on the continent. So Vermigli, as a kind of foreigner of great reputation, is allowed to leave. The Protestants in England are imprisoned, and as I'll come back to, many of them burned at the stake. Vermigli is permitted to go back to the continent. So he goes to Strasbourg, Germany, again, where he had been before. And many of the future leaders of the English church go over with him. They sneak out with him and are study with him in Strasbourg. Then he doesn't get to stay in Strasbourg for very long again because there are increasing tensions with the Lutherans there, and he's made to sign a confession of faith that acknowledges the Lutheran doctrine of the Eucharist, which is the doctrine that Jesus is physically present in the bread and the wine. So Vermigli is actually one of the greatest expounders of the Reformed doctrine of the Eucharist, the idea of the real spiritual presence of Christ, that Christ is indeed genuinely present in the Eucharistic communion, but not physically, but by the power of the Spirit. So Vermigli is actually one of the key guys responsible for articulating that doctrine. John Calvin, who's often credited with it, said, "If you want to know my doctrine of the Eucharist, go read Peter Martyr Vermigli. He has written about it better than anybody." So Vermigli can't stay in Strasbourg for very long, and he has to go back to Zurich, which is the first place he came when he fled out of Italy. So then he and Heinrich Bullinger worked together there for, I think, at this point, 4 years until his death, kind of presiding over the leading Protestant seminary, Reformed seminary, certainly, in Europe. And when he dies, shortly before he dies, Queen Mary in England had died too, and Queen Elizabeth comes to the throne and restores Protestantism in England. So then a lot of Vermigli's students who had followed him from England are then go back to England and become bishops in Elizabeth's church. And through that, Vermigli actually becomes the most important theological authority in the framing of the early Church of England, because his students are basically occupying all the key positions of influence. So it's real pity that English-speaking Protestants have almost no memory of this guy, who is perhaps even more so than Calvin responsible for, I mean, I don't want to really say more so, but we'll say equally to Calvin, responsible for kind of framing the theological heritage of English-speaking Reformed Protestantism. But he also is an interesting example of the fact that the Reformation was much more international than we realize, right? I mean, he was part of a reforming movement in Italy. He was part of reform in Switzerland, in Germany, and in England. And he's an interesting example, too, of someone who, for as long as it was feasible, he tried to kind of work from within the system. You know, he held Protestant convictions, and instead of being outspoken about them, he was sort of strategically stayed quiet so that he could build up as much reforming influence as possible within the Italian church, trying to do so without compromising his conscience. And when he was finally forced to compromise his conscience, he left. But the fact that he stayed in Italy so long actually bore a lot of fruit, because several of his students there in Italy then later came north and also became leading teachers within the Protestant universities in Europe. So, I don't know how long I took on that, and I just turned off my phone, so there's a clock there. Good. Wow, when did I actually start? Okay. Oh, so we're doing okay. Actually, since the stories are kind of separate, let me just stop. Any questions about that, about Vermigli's life? Yes. Yes. So it's kind of weird. Peter Martyr Vermigli. Sometimes he's just called Peter Martyr, which is confusing because people think, oh, was he martyred? But there was an Italian saint in the Middle Ages named Peter who was martyred, who was called Peter Martyr. So his devout Catholic parents named him Peter Martyr Vermigli. So yeah, it's a middle name, and it's confusing. So the last name is Vermigli. Yeah. Other questions? Yes. Yeah. That's why, yeah, so I don't think he never really learned English, and he didn't have to, and I don't think he really, I'm trying to think. I mean, he was very good with languages because he mastered Hebrew and Greek, but I think he read German as well. I used to know this stuff, but I don't think he ever learned English. And there wasn't that much need to, because Latin was the universal language. And so it's really interesting. I mean, so many of these reformers, actually. We know Luther, who basically just hung out in Wittenberg his whole life, and Calvin, who hung out in Geneva almost his whole life. But most of the others, really, or many of the others, had careers somewhat like Vermigli's. Nobody quite as dramatic as Vermigli, but there were reformers who taught in many different countries across Europe. And it was a much more sort of fluid international movement than we often realize. Yes? Yes. No, it's still, there was, well, let's see here. I think, well, there's only really one other that I can remember, one other case of attempting to kind of bring Protestants and Catholics together, which is fully 22 years later in France. So France is an interesting case because the French monarchs had always kind of maintained a fair bit of independence from the Pope. And although they weren't necessarily that friendly to Protestant ideas, they didn't like the idea of the Pope, you know, bossing everyone around. And it was obvious that the response to the Reformation was going to be the Pope gaining even more authority. So the Queen Mother in France, Catherine de' Medici, who actually, interestingly, is born in Florence at about the same time that Vermigli is. And that's right. Yeah, Vermigli plays a part in this, doesn't he? Yes. Yes. This is great. Thank you for bringing this up. So this is, 1562, the Colloquy of Poissy, it's called. So Catherine de' Medici there's a very strong reformed Protestant element in France, and it's numerically very strong among the nobility especially. I mean, I think it's something like 10% of the population as a whole, but it's like 25 to 30% of the nobility. So she recognizes, okay, there's a lot of very powerful Protestants here, and the really staunch Catholics are actually kind of hostile to her authority. And so she wants to work something out between kind of the moderate Catholics and the Protestants that's going to maintain her royal authority more. So there's a gathering in 1562, and Vermigli is sent to represent the Protestant view there, which actually doesn't go over that well. So it's Vermigli and then Theodore Beza, who was Calvin's successor in Geneva. And Beza was a really smooth talker. He was a real diplomat who knew how to kind of word things in such a way that everyone kind of get along with. And Vermigli is right near the end of his life at this point. He's kind of a cranky old man a bit. I mean, he always had a reputation for being kind of, you know, straight talker, you know, tell it like it is. But he seems to have been more disagreeable than usual at this stage. So Beza, at several points, kind of had sort of worked out an agreement, and then Vermigli would kind of, you know, mess things up. But even so, again, it was sort of the same way as Regensburg in that they got the Catholics to sign a kind of common statement, Catholic representatives sign a common statement on the Eucharist, which is the big thing. The doctrine of transubstantiation was the real thing they were arguing about then. And then when the Catholic representative came back to the other bishops, they were like, what on earth, how, I can't, you gave away the store. So they kind of shredded the document again, and that fell apart, unfortunately. And then that led to violent wars of religion in France, and it was a long time before Protestants could even peacefully coexist. But yeah, there was one other reunion movement as late as 1562 where it looked like there might be able to be some kind of, you know, uniting between the two parties. Cool. So with that, I wasn't sure if I was going to do two stories or three stories. I'll just do two. The other one I was going to give, which is sort of an example of, I was just going to say a bit about the colloquy of Marburg, I didn't say the connection this time of year was Vermigli was born on November 12th. So we're coming up on the 455th, no, death, I mean, he died November 12th. We're coming up on the 455th anniversary of Vermigli's death. At the beginning of October was the anniversary of the 486th anniversary of the colloquy of Marburg, which is where Luther and Zwingli tried to come together around a common Protestant doctrine of the Eucharist. It's an interesting example of where sometimes stubbornness into fidelity in a fidelity to Scripture can be a very bad thing for the church, where Luther is basically just refusing to have a conversation about the issue because he's like, well, the Bible says this is my body, so why are we even talking about this? And it leads to a profound division within the Protestant faith. But there's actually, I don't really need to give that story because my colleague Jake Meter has written up a great four-part narrative of the whole colloquy of Marburg, which is on our website if you're interested in checking that out. So I want to tell you about another story of a figure who is characterized by kind of ambiguous compromise and a willingness to stand for principle all the way to the end of his life. And this is Thomas Cranmer, the Archbishop of Canterbury, who is, of course, more than anyone, more than Vermigli, responsible for the fact that England becomes a Protestant church. But Cranmer's life is a very strange and very conflicted one right up until the end. Cranmer is a teacher at Cambridge. He's not yet ordained, but still the universities are basically seminaries, and clerical celibacy was the expectation. You were supposed to become ordained if you were going to teach at Oxford or Cambridge. And if you were going to become ordained, of course, you couldn't get married at all. Well, Cranmer rashly got married in 1519, I believe it was. So he was at that point, he was 36 already at that point. Is that right? Again, you don't really care. But anyway, so he gets married, and his wife gets pregnant. And in fact, then she and the baby both die tragically in childbirth. Which is leaves a real psychological scar on Cranmer, but is one of those strange things in God's providence that if that had not been the case,
then he would never have been able to be, because his wife dies, he's considered, and he doesn't remarry immediately, he's allowed to become ordained. And so then he's allowed to take on positions of influence within the Church of England. So if his wife had not died in childbirth, he never would have become a leader of the English Church. However, he then does something rather rash, so he becomes involved. Well, what's happening in the 1520s in England is, some people probably know the story of Henry VIII, but so Henry VIII is the king of England at this time, and he has a problem. So his father was actually the first person to bring peace after a very, very destructive period called the War of the Roses, which is this prolonged civil war in England because there's dispute about the succession. So for Henry, his England is in a fragile state. If there's not a clear succession to the throne, then England could collapse into civil war again. So it's crucial that there be a clear successor to the throne, which means, really, there needs to be a male heir. Yes, there can be a female heir. Yes, there can be a queen. But realistically, if he only has daughters, then there might be some nephew, some grandnephew, whatever, some strong male leader who makes a claim to the throne and brings about civil war again. So Henry has to have a male heir. Now, his first the problem he has is he's married to Catherine of Aragon, who's the daughter of the King of Spain. And the reason he's married to her, she was married to his older brother, Arthur, who died. They were married as teenagers, and Arthur died very, very early in the marriage. And Henry's father was like, well, you know, we got a useful bride here. I mean, she's the daughter of the King of Spain, so I don't really want to send her back. So, you know, let's put her to good use and marry her to Henry instead. So he marries her to Henry. Well, the reason this is a problem is because, according to Catholic canon law, you can't marry your brother's wife because there's a prohibition in Leviticus on it. They didn't make some of the distinctions that we now make between the ceremonial law of the Old Testament and the civil law. They thought that a lot of that ceremonial law should still apply. So you couldn't marry your brother's wife. Well, unless the Pope said it was okay, which if a major monarch appealed to the Pope, then the Pope would always, you know, he'd charge a fee, and then he'd say that's okay. So that's where both the King of Spain and the King of England wanted this to happen. So the Pope said, sure, he can marry his brother's wife, that's fine. But Henry always felt a little unsure about it. Henry was a man of sort of, he certainly wasn't a uniformly righteous man, but he was pious in his own way, and he had kind of some real pious hang-ups about a few things. And he was always concerned about this issue, that he wasn't really sure that he was supposed to be married to Catherine. And as she had miscarriage after miscarriage, he began to think, in fact, in Leviticus it says, he who marries his brother's wife, they shall be cursed, they shall be childless. So he's convinced that he's cursed by God. Well, eventually she has a daughter, but she still hasn't had a male heir, and that's critical. So as the 1520s go on, and he's getting older, and she's getting past her childbearing years, and she hasn't yet produced a son, he becomes very concerned about this, and convinced that he needs to, in fact, he never should have been married to her, and the Pope needs to cancel this marriage, right? Which you would often, as I said, the Pope was perfectly willing to do this sort of thing. But in this case, of course, the King of Spain does not want this to happen. The King of Spain does not want his daughter to have her marriage annulled and disgraced. And the King of Spain has tremendous influence over the papacy at this point. His soldiers are stationed in Rome, for one thing. So the Pope refuses to grant Henry's request. So then what happens is Henry begins consulting theologians from across Europe to get them their opinion. And to, you know, so if he can get all the theologians to kind of present his case and say, yes, this is totally wrong, he shouldn't be married to her, this marriage is null and void, then hopefully he thinks he can win his case to the Pope. So Thomas Cranmer gets, as a Cambridge professor, gets kind of roped into this process. And he's a real diplomat. He's really great at negotiating with people. So he's sent all around Europe to different universities to get theologians' opinions about this subject. So through the late 1520s, he is helping Henry negotiate this break with Catherine, which Henry increasingly becomes convinced that the Pope does not really have this authority after all. Henry had been a devout supporter of the Catholic Church, but when the Pope is continuing to stubbornly resist what Henry is convinced is the will of God, Henry begins to doubt that the Pope has authority, which, of course, lots of people in Europe are saying this. You know, Luther's ideas are getting far and wide. And Cranmer started reading Luther's ideas. We don't really know how much, but we know that Cranmer is becoming increasingly convinced, not merely on political grounds, but on theological grounds, that England should separate from the Pope's authority. So, but then a curious thing happens with Cranmer. He's in Germany for a period, hanging out with Protestant theologians there, and apparently becomes more fully convinced of Protestant ideas, though he stays very quiet about it. And he gets married secretly. Now, he at this point is a priest, which means he's not allowed to get married, though he in Germany, since it was Protestant, priests were allowed to get married. So he said, hey, you know, when in Rome, do as Romans do. When in Germany, get married, right? And it was not too uncommon even for Catholic priests to have secret wives. But within a few months after getting married, the Archbishop of Canterbury dies. And Cranmer's not really that important a person. He's not even a bishop at all in the English Church. But he's been so reliable for Henry in this whole negotiation business that Henry appoints him to be Archbishop of Canterbury. So, and it's still officially a Catholic country. So the Catholic Archbishop of Canterbury now has a secret wife. So Cranmer somehow, so he brings her back to England with him as his maid and kind of keeps her stowed away in one of the sort of, he has several different residences. So he kind of sends her off to his country residence and visits her from time to time. But everyone just thinks she's this German maid that he picked up. And somehow, amazingly, because Henry never really even when Henry breaks in the Church of Rome, Henry never really approves the idea of clerical marriage. So Cranmer can never admit to the king that he's married. So Cranmer manages to keep his wife a secret for fully 15 years, which is quite a trick. So that will probably not the best, really, for marital happiness. There was a story circulated by his Catholic adversaries later on that he had that he actually had a special wooden chest with breathing holes made that he would carry her around when he was traveling, and that's how they did it. But that's never been proven. So, but then he has to do some more kind of sneaky business, because when he's appointed Archbishop of Canterbury, Henry at this point is thinking, okay, I really need to reject the Pope's authority entirely and say the Pope has no authority over the Church of England. But he hasn't done that officially yet, and in order for the Archbishop of Canterbury to be appointed, the Pope has to approve it. So Cranmer and Henry kind of go through this, so it's complicated because Henry is still Catholic in doctrine but denies the authority of the Pope. Cranmer at this point is pretty full-fledged Protestant, denies the authority of the Pope and all of Catholic doctrine, but he can't let Henry know that latter part. And neither of them can really let the Pope know that they're rejecting the authority of the Pope, because they need the Pope to approve Cranmer as Archbishop of Canterbury. So Cranmer does the traditional, he has to swear an oath of loyalty to the Pope to become Archbishop. And so he swore his oath, and then he immediately added an oath afterwards saying that this oath did not extend, could not in any way hinder, quote, the reformation of the Christian religion, the government of the English Church, or the prerogative of the crown, or the well-being of the same commonwealth. And then he said, he also made an oath to prosecute and reform matters wheresoever they seem to me to be for the reform of the English Church. So basically he said, I swear loyalty to the Pope, except if the Pope says anything that I think interferes with the reform of the Church. So, and the thing is, the Pope was still hoping, the papal representatives in England are still at this point hoping to convince Henry to come to some kind of compromise. So they kind of let this slide. But then within a few months, Cranmer helps Henry bring through all the legislation that detaches the Church of England from the Church of Rome. But it's still a very rocky road, because for the next 14 years, Cranmer is the Archbishop of Canterbury, the leading authority in the English Church, and Henry is sometimes receptive to Protestant ideas and sometimes not. He kind of sways back and forth. He ends up, the wife that he divorced, he succeeded in divorcing Catherine, and then he marries his maid, Anne Boleyn, and then he gets angry at her after a few years and has her executed. And Cranmer is very close to the Boleyn family, so Cranmer has to play that one very carefully. And then there's several times when Protestants, who are unequivocally proclaiming Protestant doctrine in England, are arrested and executed because Henry, as I said, remains most of the time, kind of dependent on the day, most of the time remains very hostile to most of Protestant doctrine. So Cranmer has to play this careful game where he, when he has chances, he appoints churchmen and political leaders who are favorable to Luther's Reformation, but he has to officially support Henry's policy of maintaining most of the Catholic doctrines in place, and even has to sort of sign the death warrants of a couple of Protestant preachers. So he's deeply conflicted about all of this, but he has a really strong sense of his... he takes Romans 13 really seriously and feels like he has a really strong obligation to serve the king, who is God's appointed king in England. And even when the king is wrong, he, Cranmer, needs to obey. So it's a really tough period for him. But finally, 1547, Henry dies, and as I said, his young son, Edward, who's 9 at the time and has been raised as a devout Protestant, and is very precocious, actually, but comes to the throne, and Protestant counselors are really in charge of things. And Cranmer is able to bring about a thoroughgoing reform of the church. But this only lasts for 6 years. Edward dies, Mary comes back. And then, this is Cranmer. A lot of people flee to the continent. Cranmer encourages most of his friends to flee to the continent, but Cranmer says, my responsibility is to obey my ruler. I have a Catholic ruler now. My job is to stay here, and whatever happens to me, happens to me. So he stays on, but instead of executing him right away, because he's actually also guilty not merely of heresy, but of treason, because he and some other leaders tried to, when Edward was dying, they tried to divert the succession and make sure that Mary didn't become queen. So they tried to appoint a relative named Lady Jane Grey queen, and that only succeeded for 2 weeks before Mary's armies came in. So Cranmer's arrested both as a heretic and as a traitor, but because he has been the mastermind of the Reformation, they really want to make an example of him. So they're not going to kill him off quickly. So they imprison him at Oxford along with the two other leading men in the English Reformation, which is Hugh Latimer and Nicholas Ridley. So the three of them are imprisoned in Oxford until 1555. So this is from 1553 to 1555. And they start making a real effort to try to convert them back to the Catholic faith. If they can get them to recant before executing them, then it'll be a huge public relations victory. Now, none of the three of them are yielding, and on October 16th, 1555, so that's the sort of connection to this time of year, so we celebrated this just last week, Ridley and Latimer are burned at the stake in Oxford. And there's a big memorial there, where they're burned. And Latimer's last words are very famous. Cranmer's made to stand there and watch as they're burned at the stake. But they both remain very courageous to the last. And Latimer says, "Be of good cheer, Ridley, and play the man. We shall this day light such a candle by God's grace in England as I trust shall never be put out." So it's this sort of heroic moment that gives actually a lot of encouragement to the Protestants who are still kind of hiding out in England. But the authorities are then more determined than ever to try to make Cranmer cave. And so they make sure that he's now left on his own. He had been able to sort of sneak some letters back and forth to Latimer and Ridley during their last days. Now he's entirely on his own. And they start sending Catholic theological experts to him to try to convince him why he's wrong of everything. And he feels very conflicted about many of the ambiguities that he was involved in Henry's reign. And so he begins to cave on a couple points. And one big thing that becomes really decisive for him is he's left sort of in total isolation except for his jail warden, who is a devout Catholic named Nicholas Woodson. And that becomes sort of his only friend in the world. This is the only person he can talk to, and he's sort of desperate for any kind of human interaction. So he becomes very close to Woodson during these months in prison. And when he refuses to sign a recantation, when he refuses to acknowledge the Pope's authority, Woodson becomes very angry with him and refuses to talk to him again. And then Cranmer kind of has this psychological breakdown and agrees to sign this recantation. And then there's, they bring him out. They're going to have a big ceremony where he is officially removed of his archbishop's authority, and he's going to sign his recantation. And he gains his courage again, and instead of doing that, he says, I appeal to a general council for my vindication. So he says, I don't acknowledge Pope's authority. I'm appealing to a general council of Christendom to vindicate me. So they're like, oh, goodness, all right. So back to prison with him, okay, and then they start kind of psychologically working on him again. And they get him then to sign a series of further recantations, and then he crumbles entirely in March and says, I was wrong about everything. I was wrong about all of these doctrines. I appeal to the Pope for mercy. And it looks like that they've won this huge, huge public relations victory. So they're still not going to execute him. The Queen Mary is too angry at him because, of course, he was responsible for her mother, Catherine of Aragon, being divorced and kicked out of England. So she's kind of personally vindictive. So even though he has recanted his heresy, he's still going to be burned. But they want to make sure that they win the biggest public relations victory they can before that. So they take him to the university church at Oxford. He's supposed to preach a sermon acknowledging all of his errors to the world, and then there's going to be a sort of formal document published abroad with his recantation. And he kind of, the day before, he's been really kind of in deep psychological anguish, and he suddenly becomes very kind of calm and composed. And when he comes to give the sermon, he has a script that he's presented him with what he's going to say. And he starts reading out the sermon that he's going to give. And he says, and then he comes to the part where he says, and now I'm going to tell you of all of the wicked things that I have written that I need to recant. And the authority's like, yep, here's the part. And he says, just 2 weeks ago, I was forced to sign this document. I was signed all these documents, and I denied the gospel of Christ, and I recant of all of that. So and there's this uproar in the cathedral. And he yells out of the uproar, and as for the Pope, I refuse him as Christ's enemy and antichrist with all of his false doctrine. And as for the sacrament, I believe as I have taught in my book against the Bishop of Winchester, which was his famous book that he had written against the doctrine of transubstantiation. So when he says that last thing, they grab him, they pull him down from the pulpit, and just yank him off to the stake. And there's just, absolute tumult in the streets. So they take him to be burned at the stake, and he says, forasmuch as my hand offended, writing contrary to my heart, my hand shall be first punished therefore. So when they light the fire, he reaches his right hand into the fire until his hand completely burns away because of acknowledging the sin that his right hand had committed in signing this recantation. So this, of course, becomes a public relations disaster for the Catholic authorities in England and gives tremendous encouragement to the Protestants hiding out there and Protestants abroad. And because of that, when Mary dies 2 years later, there's a huge backlash against the Catholic authorities, and the Protestant faith is restored very quickly under Elizabeth, in part due to Cranmer's witness. But it's ironic that he that it was his right hand that he said was that that had offended most, because, of course, it's also to his right hand that he through which he exercised the greatest influence, right? Cranmer is responsible for writing the Book of Common Prayer, which was the attempt to put the liturgy in the common language for the common people instead of in Latin, and became the most important Protestant liturgical document to come out of the Reformation. And Cranmer's very eloquent English writing has inspired many, many liturgies since. So the same right hand that he signed those recantations with was also, though, responsible for some of the greatest texts for the of English Protestantism. So I just want to close with, close with a prayer. I need to pull it up. It's on my phone. Sorry. This is the prayer in the Church of England on March 21st, which is the day of Cranmer's death. So, or I guess I can field questions for a moment, if there are any. No, well, there are Catholics. There were a lot of closet Protestants. There were a lot of sympathizers there, too. But, yeah.
For us, I feel like looking back, I don't think of the Eucharist as being like the primary, I guess I cannot remember anymore, but the primary doctrine of religion was that.
That was the hugest issue for Cranmer, and that was the biggest thing, is they wanted him to renounce his attacks on transubstantiation. Those two were kind of equal. Acknowledge the authority of the Pope and acknowledge the reality of transubstantiation. So the doctrine of transubstantiation was one of the biggest battle lines. It was central to the whole system of Catholic authority because the priest had the power to, what made the priest special? The priest had the power to actually make Christ's body and blood present. And it was believed that by making them present, they were offered up again as a sacrifice for sin. So this was the only way that your sins could be atoned for, in fact, was by the transubstantiation in the Eucharist. So if you denied that, then the whole structure of church authority kind of crumbled. So. I don't think so. His wife outlived him, I believe. So Henry died in 1547, and then Mrs. Cranmer's able to come out of the closet, literally. out of the box, yeah. And then they have 6 years of actual, public married life together under Edward before he's arrested. So, yeah, yeah. Anything else? Yes. I don't remember how many. I remember that's one of the big things that Cranmer is concerned with in prison is that his son be allowed to retain his freedom and his that he be able to will some of his stuff to his son. All right, so I'll close with this prayer. Merciful God, who through the work of Thomas Cranmer didst renew the worship of thy church by restoring the language of the people, and through whose death didst reveal thy power in human weakness, grant that by thy grace we may always worship thee in spirit and in truth through Jesus Christ, our only mediator and advocate, who liveth and reigneth with thee and the Holy Spirit, one God, forever and ever. Amen. So, just want to say a bit, the Davenant Trust that I lead, our mission is to recover the legacy of some of these Reformation figures and their writings in order to equip citizens to be faithful witnesses and good citizens in our society today. So I'd encourage you to look at some of, I have some magazines that we print, a printed magazine called Advantes. David here does a podcast I'm sure some of you know about for us called Commonplaces, which you should subscribe to. I also have a couple books. So if you want a book, you can buy a book. If you want a magazine, you can take a magazine for free. If you want to be on our mailing list, we have a sign up. I'll have a sign up sheet down there in the hall.